It's the Leonard Lopate Show on WNYC. I'm Richard Hake, sitting in for Leonard today. It's hard to talk about American life in the 1920s, especially in New York, without invoking a cliche or so, and there's reason for that. There's the Jazz Age. Of course, there's the Roaring Twenties to describe an era of excitement and change that announced America's entrance onto the global cultural stage. In Capital of the World, writer and journalist David Wallace explores the personalities that typified the era, from gangsters to actresses to writers and dancers and madams and mayors. I'm pleased to announce it's being published by Lions Press this summer, and we'd like to welcome David Wallace to WNYC.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, you've written about the origins of the movie business in Lost Hollywood, and what drew you to New York and the 1920s specifically?
Well, a lot of the same reasons that drew me toward the so-called golden age of film, and I wrote actually four or five books about it, and that is that, I mean, it's so anecdote-filled, and it was so transformative at the time that much of the way we live right now is affected by what happened both in Hollywood at the time and certainly in New York in the 20s.
So between the two cities, were there similarities?
Yes. Los Angeles had more of a later effect than New York, because much of, as I said, how we live right now, the culture that we inherit, sort of the common language we all speak, began in the 1920s in New York with this vast explosion of freedom that was fueled by prosperity at the time, mm-hmm. as well as by illegal alcohol and whatever was going on at the time. And you had some amazing personalities that stood out at the time as well.
Now, you begin with a profile of the former mayor of New York, Jimmy Walker. What was his contribution into city politics, and what made him kind of stand out here in New York City?
He followed a very stiff mayor named John Hyland. And if Jimmy Walker was anything, he was a great showman. He started his career as a songwriter. Actually, he wrote a song some people are still familiar with right now called Will You Love Me in December as You Did in May. Huh. He served for about 10 years in the New York State Legislature, and a number of Broadway producers would send actors up there just to watch him emote. This is the way to deliver. But what made him different is that, unlike the mayors previously or many since, he really captured the love and imagination of the man and woman in the street. Hmm. His greatest legislative battle, for example, when he was mayor, was protecting the 5-cent subway and bus fare when the owners wanted to raise it to 7 cents. And he succeeded, and everybody loved him for doing that. He had the image, despite the corruption charges and things that floated around him, of being on the side of the people.
And his father had a big influence on him, right?
His father had a big influence, and his wife was a song plugger. Actually, she was, you know, plugging songs when he met her. But the father wanted him to be a lawyer. And actually, I think the chronology, I don't quite remember, but I think the father just died before he became a lawyer. And his father said, you're going to be president of the United States one day.
You know? Talk about the trouble that he eventually got into.
Well, he was close to the Democratic political organization, which was highly corrupt at the time, called Tammany Hall.
Sure.
And he got seriously tarred by that brush. No one really discovered much direct connection financially, corrupt financially, with him, other than a few friends of his sort of gave him inside tips on stocks and actually gave him stocks. But of course, you could get inside tips on stocks from your elevator operator at the time. So what's new? He, amid slight corruption charges, he won re-election with a landslide. And then he was convinced that Franklin Roosevelt, governor and then president, was going to ask him to resign because of these corruption charges. FDR apparently later said no, he didn't. And had Jimmy Walker not resigned, he probably would have won again.
We're talking to David Wallace, who is the author of the new book, Capital of the World. It is published by Lions Press. Also during this time period, organized crime had a huge influence in New York City. And almost, we look back at it almost in a kind of romantic way, and some of the characters that were involved in that.
Of course we do. A lot of that is responsible to the three Godfathers mm-hmm. films. Mario Puzo, who wrote the novel on which they were based, drew extremely accurately from a number of incidents that actually happened in New York and as the mafia became national throughout the country. At the beginning of the decade, the mafia was, you know, basically localized gangsters, getting people apartments cheap in Little Italy and all that, as was portrayed very well in Godfather 2 in the flashbacks. Mm-hmm. And then Prohibition came in, and they jumped right on that because everybody, regardless of what the law said, wanted liquor. And they got right involved in that, and by selling, by facilitating the purchase of liquor either to speakeasies or directly or however the people wanted it, they became a national crime organization. It made kings of crime of people who were just petty little gangsters before.
You write about Giuseppe Morello. Why isn't he remembered as well as other gangsters?
Well, because Luciano was much flashier.
Yeah, yeah.
And Luciano was involved in some things that showed just how our government was operating at that time. He was never caught for doing anything that he was really doing. He was framed for running a prostitution ring by the then Attorney General Tom Dewey. He never ran a prostitution ring. He went to prison. This is in the 30s, a little after our era.
Mm-hmm.
And then World War II came along. And so what was the first thing the U.S. government did? They contacted him, said, call up your friends in the mafia. Make sure we don't have any strikes in the ports in New York or anywhere else in the country. Make sure we don't have any sabotage. And then came the invasion of Italy. And they said, we would like you to contact all of your friends in the mafia in Sicily and make them our allies and give us all the information that they can about the Germans. And he did. I mean, suddenly, you know, the mafia was the ally of the U.S. Army.
Do you think the public at the time here in New York during the 20s was willing to kind of turn a blind eye toward organized crime?
Sure, because they were getting liquor.
Sure.
You know, I mean, there were 20, 30,000 speakeasies in New York City alone. They had to be fueled with something. And there were about two kinds of liquor. There was also the legal stuff that was smuggled in by a lot of very legitimate people, like Joseph B. Kennedy, who was a big smuggler. And then there was the illegal hooch that was made either from grain or, unfortunately, at times, wood alcohol, which is poisonous, that was flavored with fruit juice to make it palatable, which was the creation of the cocktail at the time.
And also, this was kind of the birthplace of the nightclub here in New York. Isn't this the time where the nightclub started appearing?
The nightclubs grew directly out of the speakeasies at the time. One of the most famous was the Stork Club, which then went on to Sherman Billingsley was at 12 years old a bootlegging liquor to Indians in the Dakotas and Oklahoma. So of course there's the other sidebar of speakeasies, which served as sort of social clubs for a lot of people. I mean, more than just going there and getting liquor. I mean, you'd have Jimmy Walker in a speakeasy, Queen Texas Guinan's thing, talking to her, you know, dime a dance guy, George Raft, who was discovered there, who then went on to Hollywood. I mean, it was all a wonderful sort of clubby thing.
Talk about what a night out in New York would be like at that time. You know, I'm imagining a flapper, a woman dressed in a flapper dress going to some hole in the walls for some cocktails.
Well, let's just talk about what a lot of people would do. You had a very popular madam in New York at the time named Polly Adler. She was a refugee, an immigrant from Europe, who failed sort of legitimate business and then backed by a gangster named Dutch Schultz, opened a bordello. She became very famous, but her bordello was unlike anybody else's. It was sort of a social club, and people like Dorothy Parker and Robert Benchley and all that would go by and start an evening there with a glass of champagne in her living room, and then go on to the theater or something like that, and then maybe come back and have another glass, and then maybe go to Texas Gwine and Speakeasy and finish the night at 2 or 3 or whatever Gwine felt like closing it, you know. And that was it. It was a real social thing that was going all the time.
Is this also the time that Americans or New Yorkers started to kind of get an interest in celebrity? The celebrity personality became evident.
That basically came out of the growth of the film industry in Hollywood. And even in silent films, never in their early days did not identify the actors or actresses. Eventually they had to, and later people would say, oh, that's Mary Pickford in that film, I recognize her, or Doug Fairbanks. As the films became more and more popular, people wanted to know more about them. And that gave rise to the gossip columnists, like, you know, who's dating whom, who's living with whom, who's doing this, who's stabbing who in the back. And
Walter Winchell, that's where he came from.
That was then picked up by a person who was a Broadway columnist, much like Leonard Lyons and Earl Wilson was in later years, who then began to really print salacious and juicy, he first called it, but then it was really salacious material on people. This made him the most powerful newspaper person in America for one whole generation. He had 50 million readers of newspaper, syndicated newspaper columns every day. He had 20 million listeners to his radio station every weekend. And, of course, eventually it all blew up. He got a little bit too big for his pants, and the people whose careers he had ruined sort of decided enough is enough, and he ended up peddling his column in the streets of L.A.
How did he get his information?
Oh. Well, he didn't, unlike is said of some tabloid journalism today, pay for it. I think a lot of it was given to him by enemies of people or rivals or something like that.
Somebody who had an axe to grind.
And then he had a very, very open telephone line for people to call in tips and things like that and really work them, and then would explode them. And, of course, he was on the right side of everything in the beginning. He was very, very supportive of the Roosevelt in World War One. Roosevelt's people would even call him to boost morale if something bad had happened, to keep people feeling good. And then, of course, he made some bad choices by supporting Joe McCarthy in the 40s and all that.
And what about the era as far as American sexual morality? I mean, was there a big change? Was there a women's change during this period?
Women got the vote in the first month or two of 1920. That's began it. Women became emancipated completely, but actually everyone became emancipated because of prosperity and because of the sort of reaction to World War One. There was this exuberance that was going on. Most of the things that happened in the 1920s were the result. The cultural changes were the result of youth pressure. It was the first time in history there was something you might call a youth quake, as it was called in the 60s. And women particularly, you know, cut their hair back, stopped wearing corsets, wore loose-fitting dresses, had bobbed their hair rather than perm, smoked in public, drank in public. There it was, you know.
My guest is David Wallace. He's the author of Capital of the World. It's published by Lyons Press. We couldn't do an interview about this era in New York history without talking about radio and without talking about broadcasting. What about David Sarnoff?
With all of the things that were going on in New York City culturally and criminally and whatever, nothing was more important in making New York the capital of America than the development of the vacuum tube and the commercialization of radio by David Sarnoff, who founded RCA and then NBC, which was then the first network. What it did was bind what was happening in New York, big bands, jazz, sports, and all that, to the people who had no access to it out in Iowa or Minnesota or something like that. Suddenly they felt that Duke Ellington, who appeared at the Cotton Club on Saturdays, his band, was playing for them. And their iconic pictures of people, whole families, sitting around radios listening in It made a national culture. Everything came out of New York. And by the same token, because there was so little happening in Europe because of the devastation of the war, it made New York basically the cultural capital of the world. It certainly was financially at the time.
Many of the lives that you chronicle in the book end sadly. Do you think that the 20s had special power to kind of generate tragedy?
That's an interesting question. Polly Adler died sort of lost and forgotten in Hollywood. Jimmy Walker died in Hollywood, but his career was long over. He died in New York. Scott Fitzgerald died in Hollywood. His career was over. I you could use this whole thing as too much too soon and then it blew up. I don't know. Maybe it's retrospect that makes it appear that way. But whatever they did, and however they died, just about everything these people did in the 20s, whether it was crime, whether it was theater, which changed totally, whether it was music, whether it was sports, whether it was our outlook on our own morals, is still with us. They affected the way we all live.
Okay, well, you can read about it, too, in David Wallace's new book, Capital of the World, A Portrait of New York City in the Roaring 20s. It's published by Lions Press. David, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it.
We'll be right back.